Welcome to a Monday on KUOW, the 15th of May. I'm Bill Radke. I'm sorry I still have a cold. A little bit later this hour, South King County will take you whether you're on your way up the ladder or on the way down.
Asians to Mexicans to white, black, everybody comes and buys the food. If you don't have the exact amount of money, we will work something out with you.
But the pressure is increasing in South King County. We'll take you there in about 15 minutes here on KUOW's The Record. So stick around. We're live tweeting right now at KUOW. First, the big news today. Ransomware is a worldwide cyber attack that hit Friday and over the weekend and continues today. And Microsoft is at the center of it. So let's get with the co-founder of GeekWire, Todd Bishop. Hiya, Todd.
How's it going, Bill?
WannaCry, it's yep. called. What's ransomware?
Ransomware is one of those computer terms that actually describes exactly what it does.
Mm-hmm.
It holds your files hostage and then demands a ransom. In this case, WannaCry or WannaCrypt, as some other folks are calling it, demands a $300 ransom in Bitcoin, which is the digital currency, in case you're not up on that lingo as well.
Yes, we'll talk a little about Bitcoin too here, but first of all, this malware, WannaCry or WannaCrypt, exploits some vulnerabilities in old Windows operating systems like Windows XP. So this is Microsoft's fault?
That is a difficult question. Software is a complex business, a complex thing to do and to develop. And this is a vulnerability in Microsoft software. So ultimately, this is something that Microsoft originated in the way that it wrote Windows. That said, the source of this vulnerability, in other words, the place that was holding it and planning to exploit it, looks to be the NSA.
Right. Tell us about that.
So this has become the new warfare, cyber warfare. So all of these intelligence agencies in the US and around the world, if they can find a vulnerability in a software program that somebody overseas who they may want to target would be using, so Windows, for example, they then hold that and in many cases keep it secret and then develop an exploit. So in other words, they can send an email to that person, get that person to click on an attachment and take over their computer or spy on it surreptitiously.
They want to use the flaw
to
hack into someone they are investigating.
The problem is that the NSA or some of these other agencies can themselves become the topic or the subject of hacks. And so then folks can find those exploits and then release them into the wild. Meanwhile, a company like Microsoft is there, and they did actually patch this for their currently supported versions of Windows back in March. The issue, as you raise with Windows XP, is Windows XP is no longer actively supported. I mean, yeah. This is the version of the operating system dating back many years now. Speaks to its popularity that a lot of folks are still using it, a very popular version dating back to 2001. So Microsoft actually took the highly unusual step, that their words, this weekend and Friday, to release a patch for Windows XP and other unsupported versions of Windows, which speaks to just how severe this particular ransomware is.
So they released a patch for the current systems that you're supposed to be running.
Back in March.
And then now they've said, okay, we'll fix the old stuff that we're not supposed to be supporting anymore. And how much has that fixed the problem?
Well, there have been a couple things that seem to have alleviated the issue a little bit today. One is that a security researcher found an apparent way to essentially lock this down. There's a check that the ransomware does against a URL, and he essentially found a kill switch that appears to have basically, by registering that domain, made it so that the ransomware doesn't activate, even though it's on the machine.
Thanks for the kill switch,
yes.
WannaCry people.
Exactly. And then also, Microsoft's patch seems to be starting to help, although that is a complex process, especially inside IT departments. And you've got to figure that the IT departments that are running Windows XP are not necessarily among the most sophisticated in the world.
Yeah, good point.
So at that point, you know, you are starting to see this patch roll out, and perhaps even people who did not update their systems in March are starting to go, oh no,
yeah,
I don't want this to happen to my machine.
And by the way, Microsoft came out publicly and basically blamed the U.S. government, right?
That's right. And they likened this to essentially somebody's weapon or a missile being stolen in some ways. I mean, this is the degree of havoc that we're talking about here in terms of what this ransomware can do, in particular with hospitals and institutions where it's a matter of life and death to have access to files and records. This is a big deal.
Yes, the UK's National Health Service got hit, and then other non-hospital huge institutions, China's National Petroleum Corporation, Renault factories in France. So is that, how important is that Microsoft came out and blamed the government? Does that matter? Is that going to change anything the government does?
It could. This government at this point, this administration in general, is kind of a wild card. And also, these are very valuable tools to these intelligence agencies. I think Microsoft had to say something because it is so unusual for them to go back and patch old systems. I mean, their whole pitch is, hey, come on up to Windows 10, yes, folks. You know, this is no longer supported. And so for them to release this patch, it's such an anomaly that they had to make it clear that this was unprecedented and blame somebody else apart from them.
Talking with GeekWire's Todd Bishop. So, and we're talking about this malware attack, a WannaCry or WannaCrypt, this ransomware attack. Is this attack a bad development for our big hometown employer, Microsoft, or is it just a problem for the attack victims?
We'll see how it plays out over this week. Okay. If this becomes worse over the next week, I think it does become an issue for Microsoft. That said, perhaps the solution to that issue is for people to get on to the latest version of Microsoft's operating system.
In which case, it's a selling point.
Exactly. I will say that it's a great reminder for everybody out there to back up your system. Get an external hard drive, use something in the cloud, make sure that if you're at home or at work, your computer is being backed up regularly, because the ultimate defense to this type of ransomware is to have essentially a mirror copy of your computer on a drive someplace else that's detached from your computer that is not getting encrypted. And so if you have that kind of rigorous backup system, the solution to this ransomware is very, very simple.
Yes, because if they're holding your stuff for ransom and you have your stuff backed up, you're not vulnerable.
Exactly.
Let's talk about this Bitcoin, this ransom. First of all, are the attackers just in this for some Bitcoin? Is that what this is about?
It seems to be. There's, of course, the chance that this could also just be about wreaking havoc. We don't yet know who's behind this attack, and so the identity of the attackers could say a lot about their motivation. So at this point, it's not clear whether it's purely financial or if there's more to it. I mean, $300 is kind of a random number. That said, it's just enough to where it's a lot of money cumulatively, but not enough, you know, not so much that an individual couldn't pay for it.
Yeah, the last I heard, I don't know how old this news was, but I was reading that global financial damages from this attack could be hundreds of millions. But as far as we knew, the Bitcoin addresses collecting ransom for the attackers measured like $35,000. So it wasn't like a big moneymaker for the ransomware people.
That's right. But if you think, we don't know if this is terrorism related, but
yeah,
if you think about sort of the modern world that we're moving into, this makes you realize just how much the online world can be turned into a weapon.
Yes.
And it's, you know, regardless of how much money they've gotten, they've certainly just created all sorts of disruption around the world by pressing keys on a keyboard, ultimately. That's what they've done here.
Right. So you said that our listeners could, whether they're individual, is this just an institutional thing? No individuals are affected?
So it's worst when it hits an institution, yeah, because it spreads through the network. The initial person who gets it clicks on a zip file that opens it up and gets it onto their system, and then it spreads without action by the other people inside an institution, such as a healthcare system, just over the net.
It only has to be clicked on once.
So one of the pieces of advice that the security researchers are giving is, if your computer gets infected, disconnect it from the network.
Okay.
So it doesn't spread.
Okay. So back your stuff up. Don't click on an attachment. That's about it.
From somebody you don't know. So another piece of advice is to not pay the ransom if you can, because the issue is that if you pay the ransom, you're just contributing to the underlying economic model that makes things like this happen in the future. One researcher that we've been talking with says also to save your encrypted files, because there is a chance that somebody could come up with a crack for it, that to get into them.
One more thing, Todd Bishop from GeekWire. I saw that Bill Gates just tweeted a bunch of commencement advice, including, intelligence takes many different forms. It's not one-dimensional and not as important as I used to think. This coming from someone who we think of as hyper, super intelligent man. And you followed Gates. You've interviewed Gates. I wondered your reaction.
The first thing that I thought of when I heard that quote was all of the people that Bill Gates worked with at Microsoft over the decades. And Bill Gates's famous phrase was, that's the stupidest blanking thing that I ever heard. that was what Bill Gates, that was what he was known for. Uh-huh. And so I thought, you know, it's very cool to see his evolution, at least in what he's saying about the different forms of intelligence that can take place. And I'm sure that there are many people who worked with him, thousands upon thousands at Microsoft, who are smiling today upon hearing that quote, because finally, you know, Bill G has come around to their way of thinking.
He's mellowed. GeekWire's Todd Bishop. Always good to talk with you, Todd. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
Coming up on KOW's The Record, how intelligent is this idea? A new Seattle bike share, but with no stations, so it's all just up to the riders to park those bikes someplace that is not annoying. That and more coming up on The Record in about 10 minutes. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Now, also big in the news today, President Trump's travel ban. Federal judges in Seattle heard arguments this morning on the revised ban on travel from six majority Muslim countries. These three judges are on the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the court which President Trump threatened to break up after they upheld the ruling against his last ban. KUOW reporter Liz Jones was at the courthouse today. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
What were the arguments by both sides today?
Yeah, well, they are looking at a ruling by a lower court in Hawaii, and it's an appeal of that ruling that put on hold President Trump's travel ban, the revised travel ban, which is kind of known as 2.0. So this is looking at whether that block of that executive order should stay on hold or should it be removed and the travel ban allowed to proceed. The Department of Justice arguing that the president has broad authority to impose travel restrictions, especially in the name of national security, and the attorney for Hawaii saying the order discriminates based on nationality, and the Constitution and immigration law passed by Congress in 1965 bans this type of discrimination.
And Liz, you got to sit there, Nina Totenberg style, and watch the questions that the judges were coming up with. And what were the questions the judges were focusing on, and what was your take on that?
Yeah, the judges were very aggressive in their questioning. I mean, the Department of Justice opened up with their initial arguments and didn't even get two sentences in before judges started asking questions. And they're covering some familiar territory, because you might remember a three-judge panel from the same appeals court heard similar arguments when Washington State brought a challenge to the president's travel ban. So they're covering some of the same arguments about, is this discrimination? Is this, in effect, a Muslim ban? How do we read a lot of the questions today were actually about how do we read the president's comments that were made on the campaign trail and made after things that, like, when he said he prefers Christians, big league, and he said that he wanted to eliminate Muslims from coming into the country. So the judges were asking, you know, how do we factor in those comments? And the attorney for Hawaii was saying, you need to look at how an outside observer would see these comments and weigh it that way. And the attorneys for the Department of Justice saying those comments should not be relevant at all. Just look at the face of the executive order, which the president and White House has gone through to take out some of the religious language that was controversial and potentially unconstitutional in the first version.
And Liz Jones, KOW reporter at this court hearing today, what do you think we can expect to happen next?
Yeah, well, the Attorney General for Hawaii, Doug Chin, and also Washington State Solicitor General Noah Purcell took questions right after the hearing today and kind of walked through next steps here. So there are several lawsuits like this happening across the country. The two that are furthest along right now is one in Maryland in the 4th District, and this one here from Hawaii in the 9th District. So these two are being heard on appeal right now. It's typical that an appeals panel like this will rule within 30 days. It could be much sooner given the high profile of this case. So those rulings will determine probably whether and how quickly this might go to the Supreme Court. It's expected this case will land in the Supreme Court at some point. It's just not sure which avenue it's going to take to get there. So if the two circuits agree on a ruling, That could mean it goes right to the Supreme Court. If they disagree, the Supreme Court could still take it up quickly because of the national interest on it. But Noah Purcell said the soonest that this would like to come before the Supreme Court would be October, given their calendar.
Reporter Liz Jones was at the courthouse today as the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals judges. A 3-judge panel heard arguments about the Trump administration's latest travel ban, that revised ban. Liz, thanks for letting us know about it.
You're welcome. Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. You know, just a few minutes ago, the co-founder of GeekWire, Todd Bishop, and I were talking about Bill Gates' commencement advice, his take on intelligence. He said that his intelligence takes many forms and it's not as important as Bill Gates used to think. I'm curious what your take is. You know, we're live tweeting this show at KUOW, so we've asked you, how true or false is that in your experience? What's your experience of intelligence? So I'd be happy to read your comments. And coming up on The Record, social media can bring you so much of the human experience, but do you want all that human experience?
Pornography, gratuitous violence, animal abuse, people abusing each other, physical fights, child abuse, sexual abuse, gory, gross out material.
Here's the thing, though. If you want that stuff off your Facebook feed, then somebody has to watch it for you in order to block it. And we'll tell you what that is like coming up in about 20 minutes here on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. As Seattle prices have soared, South King County's been a place you could afford to live, even on a modest income. Well, that's getting harder to do, as KUOW's Carolyn Adolph reports from our Region of Boom reporting team.
On a street corner in a place called Skyway, there's a young woman working a food stand.
Trust me, I've seen it all. I've seen people leave. I've seen people come.
This is Jordan Bolton, and she lives near here.
We're on 129th Street and MLK. You can get everything almost here.
We're in a chunk of unincorporated King County between Tukwila and Renton.
We have tacos and we have barbecue, so you can get some food up here. That's where I work at. I work at LT's Famous Barbecue. And then we have Tent City right in the back of us.
Skyway is a place where people of modest means try to get or keep a foothold. It's also a giant melting pot. Jordan Bolton.
I can't say there's one race. There's so many people we'll have, from Asians to Mexicans to white, black. Everybody comes and buys the food. If you don't have the exact amount of money, we will work something out with you.
She says Skyway will take you whether you're on the way up or down the ladder.
It's a place where people can come if they have nowhere to go. And Skyway will open their arms. Even if, like, even whatever you have in your past, we will wipe kind of like a new slate.
Skyway isn't the only place where this is happening. Lots of people are coming south to start over. People with lower incomes are leaving Seattle. They're heading to South King County, to places like Kent, Renton, and Auburn, in search of something affordable. Especially people of color, particularly African Americans, who had been living in neighborhoods that are now highly sought after by people with money.
When people lose their homes in Seattle, they're pushed out or bought out, or rents are going so high.
This is Gwen Allen Karsten. She's a community activist and a business owner in Kent. She's been watching as African Americans from Seattle move to Kent in search of an affordable life. At first, she says, things go well, but parts of South King County are seeing bigger rent increases than in Seattle. So a few months down the road,
you go to work and you come home and you find a note on your door telling you your rent's going to be raised and there's nothing you can do about it.
Karsten is a member of the Kent Black Action Commission, and her hair care shop is a center of black life in Kent. But affordable housing is in short supply.
We have multiple families living in places right now because they cannot find separate places for themselves.
Because there's been less building there. So people keep pushing south.
Some people are going out as far as Pacific, Algona. Some people are even venturing out to Sumner. You know, so how much further can we push people without bringing a remedy to all of this, the high rent, the escalating in costs?
Belinda Derrick works for Karsten. She says her friends and relatives are considering a new destination.
It seems like Tacoma's cheaper now.
Then you have to drive.
Yeah, I mean, the drive is a lot, but the apartment's cheaper, the living.
I accidentally made a map one time.
This is Tim Thomas. He's a doctoral student in sociology at the University of Washington. and he's been digging deep into census data.
What I found is that there's this massive shift of African Americans in Seattle moving away from where opportunity or higher income areas are.
Thomas says high rents have been driving people out of neighborhoods where their families and friends have lived for decades, places they were driven to originally by housing policies that targeted African Americans. Now they're being forced to move on. Thomas's maps show a strong trend of poor people heading south from Seattle in 2010, and that trend is stronger in 2015.
You see the migration of race as well as the migration of poverty. This massive shift of African Americans moving south, that's a big story.
There are fewer places to be displaced to.
This is Nathan Phillips of the YMCA. We're driving along the border between Tukwila and SeaTac. He stops at an old converted motel.
This is Birchcrest Apartments, across the street from Trailer Park here.
One of the few places left to go when you've been pushed out.
Your household income goes down by $50 a month. That might be enough to displace you to kind of one rung down on the housing ladder, which is sometimes old converted motels, mobile home parks, or for some families, even homelessness. There's not a lot of room left at the bottom of the ladder.
One look at the Birchcrest, and you see people trying to make it feel like home. The tree out front is decorated in Easter eggs. People have barbecues outside for cooking. But being this close to the edge in South King County is stressful. Nathan Phillips.
If you look at life expectancy in King County, our most affluent communities now have life expectancies in the 90s, approaching hundreds, and in our lower income communities, we have life expectancies in some communities in South King County, they're still in the high 60s. The place you live shouldn't be the determiner of how long you live.
Phillips says people need opportunities to get on the ladder heading up. That's something Jordan Bolton is making happen herself. She's partway through year up, 6 months of learning coder skills, 6 months of internship, like a boot camp for tech.
It's a rough 6 months, and then, I don't know, I haven't got to the internship yet.
She says she's seen people find jobs and leave the homeless encampment. Immigrants coming in and moving on.
Whether I move anywhere or any place, I'm not going to be able to change myself if I can't change myself here, so.
That opportunity to renew yourself, that's something Jordan Bolton says can still happen. In South King County, I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
Carolyn is on KUOW's Region of Boom reporting team. They are filling you in on the consequences, the pros and cons of growing as fast as we are here in the Puget Sound area. And you will find all their work at our website, KUOW.org. A few minutes ago, we were talking about the federal judges in Seattle considering President Trump's revised travel ban. Well, also in the news today, the U.S. Supreme Court left in place a ruling against North Carolina's voter ID law. A lower court had said that law was unconstitutional because it targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. And the Supreme Court left that ruling in place today. It's something you'll hear more about later today on KUOW's All Things Considered. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. What does Prince have to do with Washington State? What does Eddie Vedder have to do with you two? We have answers for you coming up in 20 minutes, so I hope you can stay with us today. Seattle may be bike-loving, but it hasn't figured out bike sharing. Not yet, anyway. The old Pronto bike share shut down this spring, but an app-based Pronto replacement might be coming. It might be coming very soon. My next guest has test-ridden one possible new bike. Tom Fucoloro, founder of the Seattle Bike Blog. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
You rode one of these bikes, the Blue Go-Go bike. How did that differ from a Pronto bike?
Well, the Pronto bikes were pretty heavy, and they're sort of bomb-proof, and that meant that they were a little clunky feeling. And this bike is kind of the exact opposite. It's pretty light, which is good, but it was also, you know, maybe felt a little cheaper than the Pronto bikes, but, you know, overall, I'd say it's a bike. It pedaled, and the brakes worked, so yeah. I was happy about it.
Now, unlike Pronto, one of these bike shares, Blue Go-Go, would not use any bike stations. So how would it work?
Yeah, actually, there's a couple companies, there's at least three that I know of, who are interested in launching in Seattle, and they all have a very similar model, where basically there's just a kickstand. You park it on an open space in the sidewalk, you know, not blocking the walkway, not blocking, you know, bus stops or in people's front doors and things, and you just lock the back wheel. And the only way to unlock the wheel is to sign in through an app, and you scan a QR code with your phone's camera, and that sends a signal through their system, and it unlocks the bike, and you bike away. And when you get to the end, you lock the wheel where you're ending, and that's it. You walk away, just kind of like a car to go, except it's a bicycle.
Tom, it's so interesting that Seattle agonized over Pronto for years, and then 6 weeks after it's gone, boop, maybe Pronto 2.0. What does that tell you?
Yeah, what's amazing is that almost all of these companies are less than a year old. So some of these companies are brand new startups who aren't launched anywhere. And then there's companies like BlueGoGo who launched, you know, honestly 6 months ago, mostly in the Asian market, and they're looking to get into North America. And they're looking at Seattle. We got rid of Pronto, and we sort of, by getting rid of Pronto, made ourselves a huge target because we're kind of a blank slate for bike share. So it's kind of like, well, come in and, you know, this could be a great place to innovate.
Interesting. You know, way to get to innovation is to get rid of the old system you had, which Seattle did. Do these new bike share companies have to wait for Seattle's approval, or can they just put some bikes out and advertise their app?
That's a good question. I mean, all of the companies I've spoken with, they're basically hoping the city will create, you know, a legal framework within which they can compete and innovate, because they don't want to, they want the city support. Obviously, that's better for them as a business. So it's sort of like the city's in this position of, if we can get ahead of this now, we can start off on a good foot instead of fighting a company that's come in and is providing a service that is going to be probably really useful and probably well used, and they're going to have to fight it and look like the bad guys. You know, instead, they can just create the rules, and then, you know, the companies can play within them. Because the other thing is, it's not exactly clear that it would be illegal to launch now without a permit. Like, there's nothing, there's just no rules against it. There's no rules saying it is legal, and there's nothing saying it's illegal necessarily, depending on which lawyer you ask.
Why would one of these stationless bike share systems be successful where Pronto was a bust?
Well, they have almost no overhead because they don't have the docking equipment, which was expensive to install and expensive to maintain. That's a huge one. And they're going to probably have smaller staffs. And the bikes, each individual bike is probably going to cost them less money. And, you know, those are a lot of costs that the other system had that these won't. You know, there's definitely some service disadvantage perhaps to not having stations. You know, you won't be able to depend on a bike always being in the same spot all the time like you could with Pronto, but there might be some advantages also because now you'll be able to bike straight to the front door of a business.
We're talking with Tom Fucoloro from Seattle Bike Blog. And Tom, you yourself have acknowledged that for this new kind of bike share system to work, people may need to have an open mind about it. What does that mean?
Yeah, they need to be ready for a lot of branded bicycles showing up on streets, you know, maybe very quickly and very soon, as soon as the city allows these companies to open. Sometimes change is hard, and we're going to have this brand new way to get around, a new transportation option when we desperately, desperately need one. You know, 1 minute standing on Mercer Street at rush hour will tell you that we definitely need to find a different way to get around. And these bikes could be a huge part of that. But that will mean that maybe sidewalks will be a little more cluttered. And if you don't ride the bikes, maybe that will be annoying to people. But I hope that people have an open mind about it and don't just immediately get angry at it.
Yeah.
Because I could see that happening. And, you know, it's not entirely irrational to not like a change that doesn't seem to be something that you were calling for. But hopefully people will understand that it could be very good for the city to have, if this succeeds.
You know, Tom, that there's some people listening, some drivers, who are saying, enough with the war on cars. Nobody wants bikes. Give it a rest.
Well, these bikes are going to cost $1 to ride. That's it. So $1 for 30 minutes. So I think that price might might be a lot of people who had no interest in using Pronto who might, you know, have a kind of a long walk ahead of them, and they'll walk by a bike and they'll see that it's only a buck and they could get there in, you know, 5 minutes instead of 15. These companies are not asking for any taxpayer subsidy at all. And in fact, they want to buy permits. So that would be street use fees into the city. Maybe pay down the balance from Pronto a little bit.
Overall, Tom, how excited are you for this possible bike share to be?
I'm very excited, especially after a year and a half of very depressing talk about bike share as this thing that I was really excited about died a slow death. But now this new concept is coming up and there's a lot of money behind it, and we might end up with a bike share system that was years ahead of what we had. So I'm pretty excited about it, but I'm ready to cover it, you know, positives and negatives, because we don't have anything like this on the streets in the US. So it's pretty brand new. And so we'll see. It's an experiment, but it could also be very innovative.
Tom Fucaloro, editor and founder at the Seattle Bike Blog. We'll be waiting, and maybe not for long, for whatever comes post-Pronto. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
The city of Seattle's working on the rules and the regs for any new bike share, and it sounds like you could be wheeling these new bikes around very soon. The city is aiming for a test run in July. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. I want to say something to the Pronto Bike Share people. If you're one of the folks who founded the Pronto Bike Share and it was hard for you to see it to suffer and go away, you feel like you tried something and you failed, here's some solace for you. In failure, you are not alone. I give you the opening weekend of King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which even director Guy Ritchie could not pull this one out of the stone. You will hear about that later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. There is a disease commonly known as sudden oak death that has infected forests in Oregon, decimated forests in California, and it's made its way to Washington. Most susceptible here, your Douglas firs, your western larches, your rhododendrons, too. It is potentially so dangerous that a lot of kinds of people are working together trying to control it. To find out more, EarthFix reporter Eilish O'Neill went to Bainbridge Island.
It's a sunny spring morning at the Bledel Reserve, a public garden on Bainbridge Island. Roads lead to paths lined with blossoming bushes and trees. Andy Navage, the director of grounds and horticulture, is showing me around.
We're getting ready to walk down to the rhododendron glen, which is a short little distance down the hill.
We're going to the rhododendron glen because that's where the gardener first spotted a problem. Back in 2015, he noticed a plant that wasn't healthy, remembers plant health manager Darren Strange.
Some leaves were dying completely, and a couple of significant branches on the plants were dying off.
So Strange took a sample and sent it to a lab. The answer came back. The plant had the pathogen that causes sudden oak death. It's a waterborne mold called Phytophthora ramorum.
I believe it's ancient Greek. Phytophthora translates as plant destroyer.
One species of Phytophthora caused the potato famine in Ireland. In California and southwest Oregon, sudden oak death has felled millions of tan oaks. Western Washington and much of western Oregon don't have tan oaks, but they do have the cool, wet climate the water mold loves, and they also have hundreds of plants that are susceptible to infection. That's why the USDA descended on the Bledel Reserve just weeks after the mold was found. They found it at 14 sites throughout the garden, Navage says.
Right from the get-go, it seemed fairly hopeless. You have a mandatory destruction zone of 2 meters, so the potential was that everything around you that you see would have to be destroyed. It instills fear and anxiety. It would be hundreds of thousands of dollars to mitigate this garden space.
Navage and his team set to work pulling plants out of the 14 sites, steaming the soil to kill the mold, and rebuilding paths to change the way water moves around the garden. The mold was detected early here because gardeners are constantly checking on the plants, but in the wild, it can spread fast. So far, it's been detected in 45 nurseries in Washington, whose stock includes infected plants brought in from California, Oregon, or British Columbia. And it's also been found in streams and rivers up and down the I-5 corridor, and in the Dungeness River out on the Olympic Peninsula. In plants other than tan oak, the water mold doesn't kill the plant, but rather some of its leaves and shoots, and sometimes its branches. But it's still a huge problem, says Gary Chestagner at Washington State University.
If it's detected in a forest or a landscape situation where it's spreading, those areas would go under a quarantine, which would have a tremendous economic impact to not only the forest community, but also the nursery industry, the timber industry, the Christmas tree industry.
In California, sudden oak death has cost an estimated $150 million in lost property values and efforts to control the disease. That's why the Washington Department of Natural Resources is trying to track its spread across the state. Early detection is the key to keeping the pathogen from doing the kind of damage to Washington's forests that it's done to forests farther south. And it's what eventually saved the Bledel Reserve, where Andy Navage is pretty sure.
We've won. I think we've won.
At the Bledel Reserve, no one's detected the mold for a year, but across the western states, people are still on high alert. On Bainbridge Island, I'm Alicia O'Neill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Arguments have wrapped up in the federal appeals court in Seattle over President Trump's travel ban. KUOW's Liz Jones was there. You'll hear more later this afternoon. Also, is it okay for a psychiatrist who has not treated President Trump to make public pronouncements about his mental health? The American Psychiatric Association debates the breaking of the Goldwater Rule. That and more this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. When you open up Facebook, what do you see? A bunch of mom photos yesterday, Mother's Day. You see photos of people's kids and links to articles that your friends want you to read, political rants from your cousin. Here is what you hopefully do not see.
Pornography, gratuitous violence, animal abuse, people abusing each other, physical fights, child abuse, sexual abuse, gory, gross-out material.
And the reason you don't see that stuff? Moderators. People who spend their days looking for objectionable images and videos and keeping them off your social media feeds. Sarah Roberts has been studying site moderation for years. She's an assistant professor of information studies at UCLA, and she's heard stories about what being continually exposed to disturbing material does to a person. Stories like what happened to this moderator.
He described to me how he'd been home one night sitting with his partner, his spouse, and they were entering into a moment of intimacy. His partner approached him and got close to him physically, and suddenly he kind of pushed his arms out and pushed her away. It was startling to both of them, I think. And when she asked for him to kind of explain what was going on or what had happened, he had a flash in his mind of something he had seen at work that was really disturbing to him. And the last thing he wanted to do was share it with his partner in an intimate moment. And yet there he was, kind of blocked from being close to her.
It makes me wonder, what's worse, being traumatized by those images or being numb?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is kind of the frightening end game for this work. Certainly, there are people who can do it long term. I was on another program once, and a gentleman called in and indicated that he'd been doing that work for 6 years in a call center in Iowa and felt he was good at it and felt he wasn't really having any serious repercussions in his own life. And really, you know, I'm in no position to take issue with that. But I do know that other people indicated that they were really reaching the point of desensitization, not really shocked or surprised much by anything. And the outcome for those people was really one of actually feeling quite jaded about the nature of the human beings that walk among us every day. You know, they would say things to me like, I feel like I know dirty little secrets about the people who pass me who are strangers on the street.
Of course, the USA is, we're the center of a lot of these platforms, but I understand a big chunk of the people who do this content moderating, going through this all this appalling stuff, they're not in the United States.
There's a certain percentage, probably a fairly large percentage, of that workforce that indeed is contracted labor. And a lot of those labor pools are in places other than the United States for multiple reasons, the least of which is the relative low cost of the labor vis-a-vis American workers. So we see a lot of this kind of work in the call center-like environments of places like the Philippines, which also benefits from having a large and young workforce and many, many people who have very, very strong colloquial American English skills and a sense of American popular culture, which all of which goes to being a successful moderator when you're moderating for an American platform.
So on top of being psychically terrorizing, this job is also really low paid.
You know, the pay varies so greatly depending on where you are in the world. Right in your own backyard in Seattle, we have a case of two workers who have filed suit against Microsoft. And it's an interesting case because those workers, unlike the vast amount of contract laborers who are out there doing this work, those workers were full-on Microsoft employees. And what we've learned about them through sort of the lawsuit filing and other information is that they were actually fairly well-paid workers. Nevertheless, these two workers allege that they are completely disabled with symptoms that appear to be post-traumatic stress disorder. So I'm not so sure that even a decent salary and benefits would necessarily offset or mitigate the kind of damage they're alleging.
I guess there's no way we can train computers to do this job, huh?
I think there's a great desire on the part of firms to introduce AI and machine learning technologies more and more to this practice. Certainly, that would help deal with the issue of worker harm that comes into play here. But even introducing that at scope and scale, I think is somewhat far off, just given the magnitude of the problem in terms of the amount of content generated. I mean, these are actually highly complex processes that we're talking about that call on some of the most human cognitive functions that are out there. And so as of yet, all of those functions have not been able to be accurately and precisely ported over into like a machine learning algorithm.
So these content moderators, they see something terrible, abusive, and they flag it to be taken from the site, but do they ever get the satisfaction of knowing that they've brought somebody to justice or helped a victim that they've seen?
One worker who worked in Silicon Valley at a major firm described to me the case that they often received reports of videos of users of the platform expressing suicidal ideation or either wishes to self-harm or actually engaging in self-harm. And the worker that I spoke to about that case explained to me that sometimes when they were able to figure out where the user was or figure out kind of triangulate information about the person enough to get law enforcement involved, they might be able to have law enforcement go do a welfare check or otherwise intervene on a person in danger. And there was often jubilation on the team when they learned that, in fact, they had intervened and perhaps saved someone's life. And I think when we talk about what kinds of things could help workers, that sense that, you know, the work that they do isn't throwaway or isn't useless, but that maybe has made a difference, that some intervention has taken place. When I've spoken to workers in the Philippines, they never had a sense for whatever happened, if anything, when they would flag material or content as abusive or problematic. All of which goes to, again, like the opaque nature of the way these practices are undertaken and meted out. Not only does the general public, by and large, not have a sense of these cases until one of them sort of slips through the cracks and becomes a public spectacle and there's outcry around it. But it may be that the workers themselves within the firm have very little sense of what happens. A lot of time there's an analogy made between content moderators and law enforcement. But of course, there's a gulf of difference between people in the law enforcement community whose work is recognized and understood and is venerated in many quarters, who have support systems and who have the means to follow up on such things, versus people who labor in the shadows, who don't have access to these particular channels and whose work is really unknown. And I think that's a source of frustration for many workers.
Sarah Roberts studies social media site moderation at UCLA,
And the problem just continues. A man was murdered on Facebook Live recently, you might have heard, and then Facebook announced it would hire 3,000 more of these moderators, bringing the total to 7,500. This past weekend, a man in Tennessee used Facebook Live to stream his suicide, setting himself on fire. The problem of social media bringing you the world, including parts of the world you just don't want to see, continues. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Good to have you with us today, Monday, the 15th of May. You know, when I was a Washington Husky, the football team's nickname was Purple Rain. R-E-I-G-N. That would be 1984. And that is the extent of the connection between Prince and Washington State, as far as I knew. Then last month, a Minnesota judge halted the release of an album of unreleased Prince songs. And the record label trying to release that album is from Vancouver, Washington. So Oregon Public Broadcasting reporter Molly Solomon met the people behind this label, RMA, Rogue Music Alliance.
I meet David Staley and Gabriel Wilson, corner of 9th and Washington in downtown Vancouver. We round a corner and slip past a nondescript door that leads to a hidden studio space Wilson and Staley fondly call Feng Shui.
It's a really cool ballroom.
A collection of guitars, amps, keyboards, and a separated drum room fill the cavernous space that used to be an art gallery. Old Persian rugs and exposed brick give the room a funky bohemian vibe.
This is basically where I produce and edit and mix from. And then artists will just be like out on the floor. I'll just be in the same room. We're all on headphones. It's very conversational.
Wilson and Staley formed the label RMA, or Rogue Music Alliance, 2 years ago when they met in Redding, California. They moved out to Vancouver and rented an office above the studio space that also doubles as Staley's bedroom.
Do you guys live here, too?
Or? I live right in there.
You live over there, okay.
Yeah, that's my little almost studio suite with its own bathroom. And
the label mostly handles Christian music. Wilson describes himself as a songwriter and worship leader online. And before last month, they were largely unknown to the public. That all changed when they tried to release this. A six-song album of previously unreleased music by Prince on the anniversary of the late pop star's death. The songs, recorded between 2006 and 2008, were a collaboration between Prince and his sound engineer, Ian Boxall. According to Staley and Wilson, they met Boxall through a mutual friend last year.
He literally said to us, a lot of the things that you say about the industry, Prince said about the industry, and the way you view the way music business should go, Prince viewed it the same way.
The independent label is far from conventional. Their website looks like a pixelated 1980s video game, and an online description calls the company a collection of pirates, hackers, artists, and bohemian resistance fighters.
I'd say hackers more in the like Silicon Valley growth hacker sense of the word versus the anonymous trying to take down PayPal sense of the word.
I suppose pirates and hackers have notorious reputations, but we're talking more about life hacks and artist hacks and ways to hack your way into the industry without giving up the equity in your work.
The whole setup is the kind of thing you'd expect from Los Angeles, New York, or even Portland, but Vancouver.
Vancouver's a great community. It reminds me of like Alberta in the mid-90s where, you know, there's a lot of dilapidated buildings that are getting developed and young entrepreneurs moving in. It just made all the sense in the world.
Shortly after the record dropped, RMA and Boxall were slapped with a lawsuit by Prince's estate and are still fighting the case in the courts. Staley says he's not surprised.
It almost goes without saying that if an independent record label is going to put out an unreleased Prince project, it's definitely going to cause some conversation and cause some buzz.
But some, like Ben McLean, an entertainment attorney based in Los Angeles, are more skeptical of RMA's motives.
Somebody just came out of the woodwork just to cash in. You know, it's like, oh, well, let's put this out and see if we can make some quick money. That's what I'm guessing is going on here.
In a recent court filing, the label says they've invested $500,000 to promote the album and have been forced to cancel appearances on The Jimmy Fallon Show and Today Show. Back at the RMA studio, the record at the center of the company's legal woes sits on a shelf. It's printed on translucent gold vinyl and held in a bright purple sleeve. a shade long synonymous with the late artist. Wilson and Staley hope the album and their cases of ordered CDs will eventually see the light of day. But for now, the record remains a display, unplayable and unsellable. I'm Molly Solomon in Vancouver, Washington.
And the update here is that Prince's estate has now agreed to pay a $1 million bond to continue to block that album from coming out. So now it's up to that federal judge in Minnesota. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Finally today, speaking of the rock and roll, did you see U2 last night at CenturyLink Field on their 30th anniversary Joshua Tree tour? If you did, you saw Bono bring Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder on stage to sing Mothers of the Disappeared. Here's a little bit of that. Eddie Vedder on stage in Seattle last night with U2. Eddie's making like a second career for himself, the surprise Seattle concert appearance. When Red Hot Chili Peppers came here in March, Eddie Vedder came out. Last year it was Bruce Springsteen and Eddie Vedder, and Sting and Peter Gabriel and Eddie Vedder. Basically, it's a perk of living in Seattle now. You can think of this as an entitlement unless your ticket specifically says the Rolling Stones, not including Eddie Vedder. Thanks for listening today, and listen some more. Get our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and talk with us. You know, we're tweeting at KUOW. We're on Facebook. Our email address is record@KUOW.org. I'm Bill Radke. Back tomorrow.